Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are trying to get our heads around the planet's operating system. Ecology. It's this incredibly complex field, you know, not like physics aiming for the 10th decimal place. Here, the rules are always shifting.
Well, they are.
And we're doing a deep dive into population ecology, how life spreads out, based on, well, an amazing lecture by Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Our goal today is kind of ambitious. Connect those huge, almost rigid forces of global physics, sun, wind, water, to the really dynamic local biological feedback loops.
Right. The things that decide where life can be, and importantly, how those populations manage to stick around without, you know, wrecking their own home.
Exactly. So first things first, what is ecology? At its core, it's just the study of how any organism interacts with its environment, everything around it, living or not.
Okay, simple enough, but we need to break that down, right? Yeah. Dr. Hoffman laid out these tiers.
Yep. The first level we're interested in here is the population. That's just individuals of the same species living together and crucially reproducing successfully.
So like all the squirrels in a particular park, that's a population.
Precisely.
But then if you add in everything else living there, the oak trees they live in, the birds, the worms, the bacteria in the soil, all those different species together.
That's the community, right?
That's the community. All the populations interacting.
Okay. And the final step.
Take that whole living community and add in all the non-living components, the air, the sunlight, the temperature, the soil itself, the water, that total package is the ecosystem.
Got it. Community plus the abiotic, the non-living stuff. And that non-living foundation, that abiotic stage, is where we need to start, I think.
Absolutely. Dr. Hoffman really hammered this home. Everything starts with the sun, continuous energy input. It arrives as electromagnetic energy, photons.
But it's not just that the sun shines. It's how it shines, the intensity. Why are the poles so much colder?
It comes down to energy density. Think about a beam of sunlight, like a column of photons hitting the Earth. At the equator, it hits pretty much straight on, perpendicular. So all that energy is focused on a relatively small circular area, high concentration.
Exactly. Maximum intensity, maximum heat. But as you move away from the equator towards the poles, the Earth curves away.
So that same column of photons hits the surface at a slant, an oblique angle.
Right. And just like shining a flashlight beam sideways onto a wall, the light gets spread out over a much larger, more elliptical area.
Same amount of energy, bigger area. Less energy per unit area.
Which means less heat. That's the fundamental reason for the temperature difference between the tropics and the poles. It's pure physics, pure geometry.
And this temperature difference is what kicks off global weather patterns, isn't it? Wind, essentially.
Wind is just convection on a massive scale, the bulk movement of air. Where the sunlight is most intense, at the equator, it heats the ground like crazy.
And the ground heats the air right above it through conduction.
Yep. Hot air expands. It becomes less dense, lighter, basically. And because it's lighter, the surrounding colder, denser air forces it upwards.
Okay, so hot air rises at the equator. But Dr. Hoffman pointed out something crucial about that rising air.
It's not just hot, it's moist. The high temperature allows the air to evaporate and hold a huge amount of water vapor.
And this rising, hot, moist air is the key to understanding rainforests and deserts.
It really is. As that air package rises, it travels higher into the atmosphere where it gets much colder.
Cold air can't hold as much water vapor.
Exactly. So the water condenses out, forms clouds, and then falls as rain. Massive amounts of rain.
Which gives us the lush tropical rainforests right around the equator where that air is rising and dumping its water.
Correct. But now think about what happens to that air after it's dropped its moisture. It's now high up, it's cold, and it's incredibly dry.
And gravity pulls it back down eventually.
It gets pushed aside by more rising air and forced to descend, typically around 30 degrees latitude, both north and south of the equator.
And this descending air is the complete opposite of the rising air. It's cold and dry.
Bone dry. As it sinks and warms up near the surface, it basically acts like a sponge, sucking any available moisture out of the ground.
Ah, so that's why the world's great deserts, the Sahara, the Kalahari, the Atacama, are clustered around that 30-degree latitude band. They're caused by descending dry air, not just heat.
Precisely. It's a direct consequence of the rainfall happening at the equator. The whole system is connected.
And this whole engine isn't static, obviously. We have seasons.
Right, and seasons are caused by the tilt of the Earth's axis, about 23.5 degrees. Not, as some people think, because our distance from the sun changes much. The orbit is almost circular.
So the tilt means different parts of the Earth get that direct high-intensity sunlight at different times of the year.
Exactly. That's what drives the seasonal temperature shifts.
And besides air, the other huge climate regulator is the ocean, right? moving massive amounts of heat around.
Huge amounts. It's important to distinguish heat and temperature here. Temperature is average energy, like the speed of molecules. Heat is the total amount of energy. The ocean stores a vast quantity of heat.
Even if its temperature isn't super high compared to, say, desert air.
Right. And ocean currents act like giant conveyor belts, moving this stored heat.
The Gulf Stream is the classic example, isn't it?
Perfect example. It takes warm water from the tropics and the coast of North America way up towards Northwest Europe.
Making places like the UK or Ireland much warmer than, say, parts of Canada at the same latitude.
Absolutely. Without it, Western Europe would be significantly colder. It's a massive heat transport system.
Okay, so global currents move heat. What about local features? Dr. Hoffman talked about the rain shadow effect, mountains messing with rainfall.
Yeah, this is a fantastic example of how local topography creates drastically different ecosystems right next to each other.
So you have moist air blowing inland from the ocean.
Right, carrying lots of water vapor. When it hits a mountain range, it has nowhere to go but up.
And as it goes up, it cools down.
And dumps its moisture as rain or snow on the side facing the windward side. Think of the rainy western slopes of the Cascades or the Sierra Nevada.
Leading to lush forests on that side.
Exactly. But the air that makes it over the mountain crest and starts descending on the other side, the leeward side, is now dry because it lost all its water.
So the leeward side gets very little rain, creating a shadow where rain is blocked.
Correct. You end up with deserts or much drier grassland ecosystems on the leeward slope, sometimes just miles away from a dense forest on the windward slope. It's all about who gets the water.
Okay, that sets the physical stage beautifully. Now, how do living things map onto these physical patterns? This brings us to biomes.
Right. Terrestrial biomes, land-based ecosystems like rainforests, deserts, tundra, grasslands are usually defined by their dominant vegetation.
Why the plants?
Because plants are the primary producers, the autotrophs. They form the base of the food web that almost all other life depends on. Their type dictates what kinds of animals can live there.
And Dr. Hoffman used climatographs to show this, plotting temperature against precipitation.
Yeah, they're really useful. You see clear patterns. Tropical rainforests are way up in the hot and wet corner. Deserts are defined by being very low on the precipitation axis.
And the key insight there was desert means dry, not necessarily hot.
Exactly. The tundra is a perfect example. It's incredibly cold, very low temperatures, but also very low precipitation. It's essentially a cold desert.
Makes sense. What about watery environments? Big difference between saltwater and freshwater.
Huge difference. We distinguish marine saltwater, like oceans and seas, from aquatic freshwater, like lakes and rivers. And the main chemical difference is salinity, the salt concentration.
Which creates a major problem for organisms moving between them. Why can't my goldfish live in the sea?
It's all about tonicity. The relative concentration of solutes, mostly salt, inside the fish versus outside in the water. Freshwater is hypotonic compared to the fish's body fluids.
Meaning less salty than the fish.
Right. So water constantly tries to flow into the fish by osmosis to balance things out. The fish has to actively pump out excess water all the time just to avoid swelling up.
Okay. And the ocean.
The ocean is hypertonic, much saltier than the fish's body. So the opposite happens. Water constantly tries to flow out of the fish into the sea.
So the fish is constantly losing water, basically getting dehydrated.
Exactly. It has to drink seawater constantly and actively pump out the excess salt. It's a totally different physiological challenge. They're specialized for one or the other.
And within the ocean, Dr. Hoffman mentioned the importance of depth, the vertical zones.
Yeah, particularly the photic zone versus the aphotic zone.
Aphotic means light, right?
Right. The upper layer where sunlight penetrates, allowing photosynthesis, that's where almost all the primary production in the ocean happens. Below that is the vast, dark aphotic zone.
Where life depends on what? Stuff falling from above?
Pretty much. Organic debris, dead organisms, waste products raining down from the photic zone. It's a completely different world down there.
Okay, so we have all these environmental constraints: temperature, water, salt, light. This leads to the big question: why isn't a particular species found somewhere? Dr. Hoffman had a really logical flowchart for figuring this out.
Yeah, it's a great diagnostic tool. It forces you to ask questions in the right order. First, dispersal. Can the organism even get there? Is there a major physical barrier, like an ocean, a huge mountain range, a vast desert?
Like, yeah, kangaroos never made it to North America naturally because there's an ocean in the way.
Exactly. If dispersal isn't the issue, if it could theoretically get there, then step two, biotic factors. Is something living stopping it?
Like what?
Intense predation, maybe it just gets eaten immediately. Or maybe there's a really strong competitor already there that outcompetes it for food or space. Or maybe a specific disease or parasite it's vulnerable to is present.
Okay, so living things keeping it out. If it's not dispersal and it's not biotic factors.
Then it must be step three, abiotic factors, non-living things. The physical or chemical environment itself is unsuitable.
Temperature too hot or too cold, not enough light, soil pH wrong, water too salty or not salty enough.
Exactly. It covers all those physical and chemical limits we talked about earlier. It's a systematic way to pinpoint the constraint.
All right, shifting gears slightly. Once a species is in an area, how do the individuals arrange themselves? Dr. Hoffman showed three main distribution patterns.
Yeah, how populations space themselves out. The most common is clumped. Individuals are grouped together.
Why clump?
Lots of reasons. Maybe resources like water or food are patchy. Or for social reasons, safety in numbers, cooperative hunting, mating opportunities. Think of a school of fish, a herd of elephants, a patch of mushrooms.
Okay, clumped is common. What else?
Then you have uniform distribution. Individuals are evenly spaced, maximizing the distance between them.
That sounds like they're trying to get away from each other.
Often, yes. Think of territorial animals, like nesting seabirds, penguins on a beach. They defend their little patch. Or some plants release chemicals that inhibit nearby competitors.
So maximizing personal space. And the last one.
Random distribution. The position of one individual is independent of others. There's no strong attraction or repulsion.
Like dandelions in a field, where the wind just dropped the seeds anywhere.
That's a classic example. It often happens when resources are uniform and social interactions are minimal. It's actually the rarest pattern in nature.
Interesting. Okay, let's look at survival over time, the survivorship curves. Dr. Hoffman showed three types.
Right, plotting the percentage of survivors against their lifespan. Type I is the curve most like us, humans, or other large mammals.
High survival when young and middle-aged, then a steep drop-off in old age.
Exactly. It reflects a strategy where parents invest a lot of energy in raising just a few offspring, protecting them well early on.
Makes sense. What's the opposite end?
That would be type 3. Think of organisms like oysters or trees that produce thousands of seeds or those dandelions again.
Massive die-off early on.
Huge mortality rate for the young larvae, seedlings. Most get eaten or fail to find a good spot. But the lucky few who do survive that initial hurdle tend to live for a relatively long time.
So, produce tons of cheap offspring, hope a few make it, low investment per offspring.
Precisely. And then type 2 is kind of in the middle, a constant death rate over the lifespan. Age doesn't really affect the probability of dying much. Some birds, rodents, lizards show this pattern.
Okay, that covers survival patterns. Now for the math of population growth. Dr. Hoffman started with the simple but unrealistic model.
The exponential growth model. The J-shaped curve.
Where the growth rate itself gets faster and faster as the population gets bigger. Because the rate depends directly on the number of individuals reproducing.
Mathematically elegant, DNDP equals RN. But as you said, totally unrealistic in the long run. No population can grow exponentially forever.
Why not?
Resources run out. Space runs out. Waste builds up. Nature imposes limits. Which brings us to the much more realistic logistic growth model.
The S-shaped curve.
Right. It starts off looking exponential when the population is small and resources are plentiful. But as the population size, N, increases, the growth rate starts to slow down.
Because it's approaching the environment's limit.
The carrying capacity, symbolized by K, that's the maximum stable population size the environment can sustain long term. As N gets closer to K, the growth rate approaches zero.
And Dr. Hoffman pointed out a really interesting spot on that S curve. Where is the population growing fastest?
Right at the inflection point, which mathematically occurs when the population size is exactly half the carrying capacity, N equals K2.
Why then?
It's the sweet spot. You still have enough resources for rapid reproduction, but the negative effects of crowding haven't fully kicked in yet. After K2, the brakes start getting applied more strongly.
Okay, so what are those brakes? What stops exponential growth and keeps populations following that logistic S-curve?
These are the crucial density-dependent factors. Their effect gets stronger as the population density, the number of individuals per unit area, increases.
Like what? Give us some examples.
The most obvious one is competition for resources. More individuals means less food, water, light, nesting sites, or territories to go around for each one. This slows birth rates and increases death rates.
Makes sense. What else?
Predation. When prey are scarce and spread out, predators have a hard time. But when prey become abundant and crowded, they're much easier to find and catch. So predation rates often go up as prey density increases.
Okay, predators respond to density.
Disease and parasitism too. Pathogens spread much more easily in crowded conditions. Think about how quickly colds spread in packed classrooms or airplanes. Higher density means higher transmission rates.
Yeah, that's intuitive. Any others?
Accumulation of toxic wastes. As density goes up, waste products can build up to harmful levels. Dr. Hoffman used the example of yeast and fermentation.
Right. They produce ethanol, which is alcohol.
Which is toxic to them. As the yeast population grows and ferments sugar, the alcohol concentration rises until it kills them off, limiting the population size and the final alcohol percentage. They literally die in their own waste.
Wow. That's a harsh limit.
And finally, there are intrinsic factors, sometimes called physiological factors. In some species, especially vertebrates, high population density itself can trigger stress responses that reduce reproduction. In crowded rodents, for instance, stress hormones might increase, leading to delayed sexual maturity, smaller litter sizes, or reduced immune function, all of which help regulate the population density from within.
So multiple factors work together, getting stronger as the population gets more crowded, pushing it back towards the carrying capacity.
Exactly. These density-dependent factors are the feedback loops that generally keep populations stable over time.
We can see this play out dynamically with predator-prey cycles, right? The wolf and moose example Dr. Hoffman showed.
That's a classic illustration. You see oscillations. Lots of moose mean plenty of food for wolves, so the wolf population booms.
But a booming wolf population puts heavy pressure on the moose,
causing the moose population to crash. Then with fewer moose, the wolves start to starve and the wolf population crashes.
And with fewer predators around, the moose population can recover and start to boom again.
And the cycle repeats. The two populations are linked, but their peaks and troughs are out of sync, creating this dynamic stability.
Okay, so let's try and pull this all together. We started with the big physical drivers: sunlight, temperature gradients, wind, ocean currents, mountains shaping rainfall.
The global operating system, the abiotic stage.
And then we zoomed into how populations respond, where they can live, how they arrange themselves, their survival strategies, and crucially, these density-dependent factors that regulate their numbers.
Right. The distribution of life across the planet is fundamentally constrained by that large-scale physics and chemistry. But the persistence and stability of life in any given place relies on these local biological feedback loops tied to population density. Everything is connected, from the angle of sunlight hitting the earth to the stress hormones in a crowded mouse.
So here's a final thought to chew on, building on Dr. Hoffman's framework. Those big biophysical factors, the amount of sunlight, the rainfall patterns, ocean temperatures, Dr. Hoffman presented them as largely independent of how many organisms are there. They're the background conditions.
Generally, yes. Abiotic factors.
But what happens when those background abiotic conditions themselves change? Say, due to climate change, a region gets significantly less rainfall than it historically did, or a key ocean current warms up dramatically. How does that sudden shift in the abiotic foundation immediately put pressure on the biotic limits?
You mean it lowers the carrying capacity?
Exactly. Does shifting the abiotic baseline instantly tighten the screws on all those density-dependent factors? Does competition become fiercer overnight? Does susceptibility to disease skyrocket because everyone's already stressed? Could populations crash much faster than their internal feedback loops can adjust, simply because the environmental rug got pulled out from under them? That interaction, that pressure point between changing global physics and local biology, feels like the absolute core challenge in ecology today.